born in the pandemic era, thriving in the Zoom era. It's Resonance Rewind.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. The known universe is ruled by the Padishah Emperor Shaddam IV, my father. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel. The Spacing Guild and its navigators, who the spice has mutated over 4,000 years, use the orange spice gas, which gives them the ability to fold space. That is, travel to any part of the universe without moving. Oh yes, I forgot to tell you. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. A desolate, dry planet with vast deserts. Hidden away within the rocks of these deserts are a people known as the Fremen, who have long held a prophecy that a man would come, a Messiah, who would lead them to true freedom. The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
But how can this be? Is it because he is the Kwisatz Haderach? David Lynch, of course, behind this particular movie, not one of his favourites, it would seem, although I have to say I thoroughly enjoyed it in 1984 and still enjoy it now. I'd arguably say it paved the way for a whole stack of science fiction movies and so on. And as Jared Palmer will acknowledge, I've also done a comparison between the 1984 Dune and, of course, The Matrix by the Wachowskis a decade or a half later. Jared, let's come to you first before we invite our David Lynch aficionado and general scholar to actually share his thoughts on the whole thing. Jared, your thoughts on this 1984 Dune?
Well, this was my second time watching this film. I'd watched this the first time to prepare for the remake, which came out last year. And the year before last. And I really did enjoy it. And even though, like, I could tell that the problem was that there was a lot of interfering from the studio and also a lot of scenes that were cut, because I think at that time you had to only do a 2-hour film. And the problem is they tried to do so much in a short amount of time. But I think for me, it still holds up. It works pretty well. And honestly, I think the actors did an amazing job. And I think the hard thing was is trying to compete with Star Wars. And I think that was the problem with Dune. It just came in the wrong time.
Interesting in terms of the competitive thing. The cast is phenomenal. I mean, it's almost as though you've got some of the Twin Peaks alumni as well in preparation. Kyle MacLachlan, obviously, Everett McGill, very much there. Patrick Stewart, of course, before he became Jean-Luc Picard. Paul L. Smith as the Beast Raban, and Sean Phillips, of course, as the Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam. Not to mention, of course, Linda Hunt as my favourite soul, the Shadat Mapes, the housekeeper, which I thought was wonderful. Kyle MacLachlan, as I mentioned, as Paul Atreides. Let's turn to Phil Leonis. Phil, you've got, I think, one or two interesting points about this, and probably echoing the notion that David Lynch, the director's cut, which was mythically put together, that it's out there somewhere, never really existed.
Right, it does not, as he has been quite quick to point out. I have seen this film twice, I believe, and did not watch it in anticipation of today's show. Ordinarily a situation, Alex, you know, I try to avoid, which is why I don't participate on Resonance Rewind more often, because I feel that it would be my responsibility to be fresh with my thoughts on this. But I did have one or two points just that I think are important for storytellers and filmmakers that pertain to this project. You alluded to David Lynch's own feelings of misgiving about the film. And I once was fortunate enough to have an interaction with him at a film festival, and I was confiding in him. He knew that I had directed a particular movie, and I was confiding in him how, I don't know, not traumatizing, that's not the right word, because of course it's disrespectful for people who are experiencing actual trauma, but heartbreaking. At the very least, heartbreaking experience that I had making a film that really almost had me questioning whether I wanted to continue making film. And he talked to me about Dune, and he said the hardest parts of this work are when you yourself don't believe in what you did, because that's when the criticisms hurt, because deep down, you know, you failed to achieve what you thought was possible. And Dune for him was that heartbreak. And at the same time, as he pointed out, why it's so difficult is that you can't, if you have any sense of integrity, try to distance yourself from your work. One, because you never know when you're going to be talking to people who like it. And it's terrible to go through the world taking a smile off someone's face when they enjoyed it, even though you, as the person who made it, can only see how it didn't live up to your ambitions. But also because your works are like children. That analogy has been used before, that metaphor, and it's a little silly. But where it's true is that the works that you have that have the hardest time making friends in the world, you actually have to love the most. And that's easy to do no matter how much someone derides your work if you know you did what you set out to accomplish. But in this case, he knew he hadn't. And so it was very hard to love this misbegotten child the most.
It is interesting insofar as I had an awful lot of comments from fans of the original book who said it works fine until they actually leave for Arrakis and the Atreides family effectively go off to their adventure. Then it sort of the pace picks up and it becomes a phenomenal race to the end, really. I think in terms of the actual way it pans out, admittedly, we're not looking at the Denis Villeneuve incarnation, which obviously has gone over two motion pictures, and it is an epic novel in itself before we even start talking about its sequels. Dino De Laurentiis probably had something to do with the notion of obviously rolling it out, because obviously Dino, known in the past for the remake of King Kong, another movie which I think we need to actually look again at, because I think Jessica Lange had a wonderful line and series of lines in that. And also,
wasn't
of course,
Flash Gordon you were about
yes,
to mention?
Flash Gordon,
yeah. And I feel like there's a degree to which, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I feel like there's a degree to which you can picture Dino thinking that this would come across like Flash Gordon.
Yeah, to a certain extent. Although I still would say, as somebody who has read and followed and actually delivered academic papers on Dune, this is pretty close to Herbert's original incarnation. And certainly the work of Kyle MacLachlan as the triple whammy, of course, Paul Atreides, then Paul Muad'Dib, and then, of course, the Kwisatz Haderach, I think worked extremely well. Interesting that Jessica, of course, Lady Jessica, played by Francesca Annis, did also comment that she felt any movie that actually has to explain with her narration at the start what it's about is not necessarily what she would rate as a good movie. Again, something I would actually have to disagree with. But Jared, let's turn to yourself. I mean, again, some of the characterizations here: Freddie Jones as Thufir Howard, Richard Jordan, of course, as Duncan Idaho. Richard Jordan, of course, who would appear in a whole range of subsequent sort of texts as well from that point of view. Any thoughts in terms of favorite moments, let's say, before we start going into characters?
Well, I would have to say my favorite moment for Dune would be probably towards the end as well as when Paul comes in and he's standing tall against the Emperor and everyone else in there. And even some of the lesser beings from the Emperor's perspective are afraid of him because of how powerful he is and what he's become. And I think for me, it's also where he starts to develop that role of becoming the leader as well. And I really did enjoy that scene. I think the other scene I did enjoy was the bit where he and he's like doing his own thing, and then like Gurney come and the others come in, and then he just smugs look of him saying that I knew it was you, and then it's like they're like towing him off, like those moves could have been imitated. It was like I would know the difference, and then of course that leads to Patrick Stewart as Gurney attacking Paul, which I actually thought was pretty interesting, and I always have enjoyed a lot of films with Patrick Stewart, and I definitely did like this one. And it was pretty clear that his Shakespearean acting background came into this, and I could just see him smirking in there for being like the big Shakespearean figure. So I think I enjoyed that moment as well.
That's Gurney Halleck, of course, who also used to look after the Duke's pet dog, I think, which we never see too much of, but he comes across interesting from that. I'm not sure whether you can remember any favourite moments. I mean, I cited Richard Jordan, of course, Phil, but in terms of the actual film itself, he appeared in a previous incarnation as Francis in Logan's Run. Which I know was a movie we looked at in another series, actually, Culture Makers, I think, before a sort of precursor to Resonance Rewind, which.
Richard Jordan, I think, was an actor that never really quite got his due. There's an early kind of neo-noir. It might have been his first film, Friends of Eddie Coyle, a late career wonderful performance by Robert Mitchum. I think it might have been Peter Yates that made that film. But Richard Jordan was a wonderful actor, and you're so right. Like the care and quality of assembling that seemingly bizarre ensemble. Because it is pulled from so many different walks of not only the acting world but the entertainment world, it's really quite incredible and almost thrilling the some of the chances that they take in terms of the casting. I w will answer the question about favorite moments in a very odd way of comparing it to the Denis Villeneuve film, but I just wanted to follow up on something that I thought about when you were comparing it to how it really seemed to do an honorable job insofar as it was within its power, because again, we've talked about how it was cut down and it truncated, and then the need to use things like narration sometimes to fill in the gaps because they weren't allowed to tell the story. But it does an honorable job of approaching the source material, but it also underscores just what a untenable situation this was from the get-go, because this was a movie back then that had to serve many masters. It had to serve those people that love the book. It had to serve the fans of Star Wars who expect a 2-hour space opera adventure. And it had to, of course, serve the fans of David Lynch and his own artistic impulses. You mentioned Kyle MacLachlan, and can you imagine, honestly, looking back, how many filmmakers who emerge from the box office disaster and financial failure that was this film upon its initial release, how many filmmakers would have distanced themselves from the unproven leading man? And Kyle MacLachlan is quick to point this out, that one of the things that's so special about David Lynch is when David is working to get his next film off the ground after realizing he will never do a job for hire again, that the problem with having too many masters, serving too many masters, is serving any masters at all. And so he works diligently to get Blue Velvet made, and never gives up on giving Kyle MacLachlan another chance to prove himself as a leading man. And very few filmmakers would have done that. Anyway, in terms of moments, I would just like to say, I think the Denis Villeneuve Dune is a masterful bit of storytelling. I am looking forward to the sequel. That said, there is only one scene in the Denis Villeneuve Dune that I think reaches the level of just the magic, the cinematic magic of so many scenes in the David Lynch Dune.
A very
And
interesting comment. Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree actually in terms of that. Some people might say that's sacrilege. I mean, I like Villeneuve's work. He's produced some outstanding work. Obviously, Arrival immediately springs to mind, and Dune, and has a love clearly. And of course, the other interesting connection when we were talking about movies with voiceovers, of course, Sean Young previously appeared in Blade Runner. another movie which Ridley Scott has released with voiceover, without voiceover, and there's lots of debate in terms of whether the Harrison Ford voiceover is better or not than the case is actually provided. Jared has made an interesting point as well, quite right. The pseudonym Alan Smithy, a bit like Harlan Ellison would always use Cordwainer Bird if he didn't like the work, basically, and needed to actually put up a pseudonym for that. Phil, have you ever done that, actually, just on a slight aside? Have you ever actually directed something and then used a pseudonym because you just thought, no, I don't think so?
I thought about it one time, again, one project in particular, but the reason I did not was for the same reason that David Lynch, really, I believe, did not for the theatrical release of Dune, which is, again, distancing yourself from the work is not an honorable thing to do, just to let people know, hey, this isn't my fault. Especially because what you're doing is you're distancing yourself from all the hard work that all these other hundreds of people put into this piece, believing that they were hopefully serving a greater good, for lack of a better phrase, but that they were on team with you. Your team has their names on this film, and you're going to remove your name when they may have very well done the film because of you. And so although it is true that he used Alan Smithy for all other versions, what's kind of refreshing again is he stood by the version, the compromised version as it was, that was released to theaters. It was only then, when other changes were made without his involvement, that he then removed his name. So no, I've never done it, Alex. I wouldn't say never. If it was a similar circumstance where a film got released and then someone else changed it in some dramatic way, especially if I thought that it was somehow in some way changing the meaning of something, then I might consider it. But I certainly, good, bad, or indifferent, I would never take my name off something just to distance myself from the feeling of failure.
Looking at the team, of course, Phil, we see cinematography by the awesome Freddie Francis, who had worked before on The Elephant Man with David Lynch. Francis, who sadly passed away in 2007, so a few years ago now, but again, somebody who was very known for, again, the quality of his work, Cape Fear, The Straight Story, Glory, all part of the work that was actually in there. And I'd also even give a mention to Toto, because people were saying, oh, the music wasn't great. I thought they did. I mean, obviously known for the single Africa, amongst others. I felt that Marty Patch and Toto did a very capable job in getting a sense of the epic notion of what we were seeing here. Jared, from your own perspective, I mean, is it something which, you know, as a film student, as a film studies graduate, did you sort of feel the cinematography stood out and the sort of things that Phil was just saying in terms of the epic nature of the scenes?
I think from looking at it from my perspective, because I've grown up with a lot of the big epics of science fiction as well as other films in terms of like Star Wars. And I think for me, it does it pretty well, actually. I think because of back in the day, CGI wasn't like huge as it is today. I think it only started becoming a thing around about the 90s. And even in the early 2000s, it still wasn't as well as we know it today. And I think for me that it works really well, because I think the sort of the vintage feel you have from the sets and also from the planets and also like the atmosphere of being on Dune and the sand, I think it just works really well. And I think that's what sort of helped the new one to also bring that sort of epic adventure style feel to it for me, because I feel as if they took a lot from what the original did and sort of like showed what we can do now with the effects we have today. And I think even looking back on the 1984 version, it still holds up. And I think overall, I think practical effects are a lot more effective than using CGI. Sometimes mixing between them works, but I think overall you won't get as vintage feel if you use CGI. And
Jared, I read a quote from Quentin Tarantino recently that was something along the lines of, if you don't do it in camera, it doesn't count. That's what he that's what he said. Alex, am I allowed to ask you a question?
Of course.
About this? You used the word epic, and it occurs to me that big budget, small budget, intimate, or large ensemble, David Lynch's work can always be described as an epic of imagination. And I'm wondering if, and that's clearly on display in Dune. I mean, that's why, yes, I would have no problem with anyone saying that the Denis Villeneuve Dune is a much better movie. But for me, the David Lynch Dune is a much more interesting one because of this element of epic of imagination. And am I wrong in saying that there is something about that, about an epic of imagination that connects to what makes the underlying text, the Frank Herbert works, resonate? That there's something particularly thematically relevant almost to making this film as an epic of imagination.
In the 1960s, this was regarded as the first ecological science fiction narrative, first mega science fiction narrative. There were others that were peripheral and which certainly deserve honorable mentions. But I think you can also see it as a metaphor and an allegory for the Middle East situation, as OPEC, represented by the CHOM Company Guild. We have the folding space, we have the control aspects that come across within that. And again, those narratives, those tropes were woven together so neatly here, I thought, and still tend to do. I mean, just returning briefly to the cast, I mean, we haven't even mentioned Dean Stockwell as Dr. Huey, the traitor. Dean, of course, again, much beloved with respect to Quantum Leap and others. Max von Sydow. I mean, Max von Sydow is Dr. Kynes, the planetary ecologist, and so on. And of course, Jürgen Prochnow as Duke Leto Atreides, Sean Phillips, as we've already mentioned, Reverend Mother Gaius Helen Mohiam, who, again, that notion that actually the reason that the Baron Vladimir Harkonnen was so disfigured was because effectively he'd been poisoned by her because he'd attempted to rape her in other narratives. So again, areas there that, you know, were problematic. And let's not forget, of course, Sting, in what was probably the most cliched and stereotypical aspect of the whole thing, as Fade Rauter, of course, one of Baron Harkonnen's nephews, I think. Or was he his son? I think he was a nephew.
I'm very impressed that you've talked about this performance and resisted your predilection for saying underpants.
I felt we needed to pull back because of the somber nature of the actual analysis, because, you know, there's certain areas we needed to just work on that system. Jared, favorite character? I mean, I've mentioned a whole range of things there. Alicia Witt, of course, who uttered those immortal words, "Wait for my brother, Baron," and other things. And Paul has taken the water of life and so on. Where are you going to go? And do you have any honorable mentions?
I will say, I think my favorite character overall is Paul Atreides. I think he does it well in the lead, and I think Carl did a really amazing job with Paul. I think he's the one that stands out to me for the most. I will say, for honorable mentions, I did like Sting in this film. I thought he was really fantastic as like a sort of a radical sort of warrior who's like willing to do whatever it takes to win. And I did like at the end that he tries to cheat using his torso with a hidden blade in it. I thought that was an excellent move. And then in the end, it fails to work. And that's what I liked about the ending, is that despite that, he still lost. And I would say also Patrick Stewart, whenever I watch him in anything, if it's science fiction, if it's in X-Men, or it's in a Shakespearean play, or he's being executed or anything, he still does a fantastic performance in whatever he's in. So I'll leave it at that for the moment.
And Phil, any characters that you can recall who'd like to say, yes? I mean, I've already thrown my hat in the ring for Linda Hunt as the Shadat Mapes, the housekeeper, which I thought her sort of character was feisty. And again, obviously one of the Fremen spies who's working in House Atreides.
Well, we've talked about this before, but the best thing that you can do to get a good performance is to cast the right person in the first place. And there really are, whether or not, again, much of their character arcs were cut out, there are so many people where they fit in such an interesting way to their character that, again, one of the things I love about this film is that you can truly imagine their lives and their adventures outside the frame of the movie you're seeing. The sad thing is, all too often, we do have to imagine that because we weren't allowed to see those things. But, you know, you mentioned, as I recall, this was at like the beginning of the real, oh my goodness, the comeback for, who were we just talking about from Quantum Leap? Dean Stockwell. This was like the beginning of a real, he had just done Paris, Texas with Wim Wenders. And of course, he would do Blue Velvet. And he's so interesting as Dr. Yui. And you mentioned Richard Jordan already. I mean, I was so delighted that you did, because I think Duncan Idaho, I think that performance in there, it really, if you look at that, it's a sign of how great a movie is in there. They knew what they were doing if they'd been allowed to do it entirely. But finally, yes, I have real appreciation for Kyle's performance. And, you know, you learn later that this book meant everything to him when he was growing up, and his willingness to just hand himself over as an, you know, fairly inexperienced actor. I don't think he'd done any screen work before. And just his willingness to let go of any ideas he might have had about it. Because let's face it, the danger of casting somebody who loves the underlying material is they might think to themselves, oh boy, when I get a hold of this, I'm going to show them how much I love it. But he was a willing instrument of the storyteller. And it's a really kind of noble performance in that way, and a very pure performance. And so, you know, again, thank goodness Lynch stuck with him and gave him a chance to show off his wares in a movie that everybody could embrace a few years later.
The sleeper has awakened, coupled with, of course, the conversation between his father and Paul Atreides.
And how much is that? How much is that a theme that runs throughout Lynch's work? Right. I mean, right down to Twin Peaks, The Return, instead of the sleeper has awakened, it's the dreamer of the dreamer. But who is the dreamer? Right. That is the underlying mystery to unravel in Twin Peaks, The Return.
And as we look ahead to Twin Peaks, we actually go to Twin Peaks episode one, or the pilot episode for our next Resonance Rewind, in which damn good cherry pie is had by all. And we also welcome back Machen Aidmick and, of course, Peggy Lipton. Sadly, again, no longer with us, but Peggy, a connection with one of our key past Resonance Rewinders, Arthur Weingarten, of course, because Peggy Lipton, her first major break was in The Mod Squad, which Arthur, of course, wrote and produced for the season. So an interesting cross-reference there. However, we still need to actually have a score out of 10, quantifying the qualitative, admittedly, for June. Jared, what's your score going to be?
I would say overall, I think after watching it a second time, I would give it a 7. I think overall it had a very strong premise. I did like the build-up with the narrative of Virginia Madison, and I think it explained it very well. I think if maybe they had done what the current one did and split it up, I think it may have worked in their favour, but overall I think it does the story justice. I think it adapts the novel quite well from what I've heard. And I think overall, it is a fun and amazing film to watch.
For all those reasons, and because it was seen by me first and foremost in a cinema in Cambridge when I was having my first ever teaching post back in the day, I'm going to go for a 9 out of 10. Not quite a full 10, because, again, there are one or two flaws that, as we've pointed out, are there. And I think David Lynch is far too hard on himself. I'd obviously say that. But Phil, do you want to pop in your own particular score?
I'm curious. I know that we're not talking about the Villeneuve Dune per se, but what, Alex, would you give the Villeneuve Dune then?
8.5.
8.5.
And what, very
and what good. Would you, and what would you give Fellini's 8.5? No, never mind. I'm going to say I'm not acquainted enough. I'm not a fan enough of the underlying novels to know what this experience would be for people. So I rely on you for that.
Duncan Idaho does actually make a much greater appearance as a Gola, G-H-O-L-A, and appears sort of later, a kind of not quite ghost, not quite sort of real person. But it would have been interesting if they'd gone on to follow the sequels to see whether indeed that would have been a further expansion of the role that we would have seen. And in many ways, he, Duncan Idaho, becomes almost, as Paul Atreides becomes the Messiah, mini spoiler here, he becomes more of the hero than the Atreides actually is, as the Kwisatz Haderach.
I think a 7 is a good score for this, in that I can't tell people with certainty that they're going to find this to be worthy of their time. I can't say that with certainty, but I would point out something that I know to be absolutely true, which is a great filmmaker's misfires are more interesting than most filmmakers' hits. And so you'd be well advised, everyone would be well advised to watch this film, to see this film, to appreciate this film, even if they find reasons why it does not work for them. It's still really interesting and sometimes absolutely thrilling. It's an epic of imagination.
And with those words, we will hopefully also find out in a few moments' time what our own Jessica Burtis, actually thinks of Dune later in this program. For now, to Phil Leonis and to Jared Palmer, huge thanks. And obviously, guys, keep on resonating.
A beginning is a very delicate time. Know then that it is the year 10,191. In this time, the most precious substance in the universe is the spice melange. The spice extends life. The spice exists on only one planet in the entire universe. The planet is Arrakis, also known as Dune.
You are about to enter a world where the unexpected...
Many dangers exist on Arrakis.
The unknown, an incredible secret has been kept on this planet. And the unbelievable meet.
I see two great houses. Fury.
Where kingdoms are built on earth that moves.
We have one sign, the likes of which even God has never seen.
And skies are filled with fire.
The prophecy which will cleanse the universe and bring us out of darkness.
Where a young warrior is called upon to free his people. A world that holds creation's greatest treasure.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
And greatest terrors. A world where the mighty...
This is genocide.
The deliberate and systematic destruction of all life on Arrakis.
The mad.
I will kill him!
I will love you forever.
And the magical.
Father, the sleeper has awakened!
Will have their final battle.
Long live the fighters!
Show the slightest pity or mercy.
Emperor, we come for you.
Dune, a spectacular journey through the wonders of space and the mysteries of time. From the boundaries of the incredible to the borders of the impossible. Now, Frank Herbert's widely read, talked about, and cherished masterpiece comes to the screen. Dino De Laurentiis presents Dune, a world beyond your experience, beyond your imagination.
Well, we've heard what Phil Leonis makes of Dune. We've heard of, obviously, Jared Palmer's thoughts on Dune. What about the female take on this epic Frank Herbert adaptation by David Lynch in 1984? Anna Teodora Koskinen, thoughts, please.
I was pretty sorry to see that he thinks it's not a really good movie and that he thinks it's the real failure of his career. I think it sometimes, as Phil said earlier on, movies are like our kids, so we have to love them regardless and think that even though maybe they weren't our best work, they were still something that moved that helped us to move forward. So having that in mind, I think I can say it wasn't one of my favorite movies to watch. I did watch it, and I do know about the novel from 1965. Actually, I knew about that before watching the movie, but I think it was let's say with a good intention made. When you don't know what to say about the movie because you don't, not necessarily to upset anyone, but you don't like to say that you didn't really enjoy it. You're just gonna say it was a good performance.
I think for those of us who are used to the epic in cinema, and I'm talking about movies such as Lawrence of Arabia and clearly the epic scope of the whole sequence, I think it does certainly echo aspects within that. I've already said I think David Lynch was far too critical in terms of his own thoughts about the experience of the 3 years of making Dune. But I still think it actually stands up as a vital, important analogy of how we deal with religious wars. I mean, we haven't really spoken about the Bene Gesserit sisterhood, of course, and their litany against fear. I must not fear. Fear is a little mind devil that brings with it total obliteration. The Gamgee-Barr test, the whole sense of the Messiah that's very much being pushed at this whole side of things there. Again, unashamedly, I still like it. I liked it, the original incarnation. I don't dislike the latest version, and I'm not necessarily going to focus on that because that's for another Resonance Rewind with Denis Villeneuve. But I feel that one advantage that Villeneuve has that wasn't afforded to David Lynch was he actually had more time to develop it. And I think there is a sense that actually this is a movie, although it's a little over 2 hours, it does tend to race to its ending fairly rapidly, which some might say in our current climate of attention spans being minuscule and TikTok being the overall ruler for the musical industry might be a way forward. But what about favorite moments, Anna? I mean, yeah, I know you're not necessarily key to the whole thing. Were there any particular moments that stood out to you?
Well, what I want to add before that is I really do think what you're saying is right with that they didn't have too much time to put to have everything they wanted to add in the movie because I think it's a movie for, let's say, over 4 hours instead of two. And they tried to encompass everything in 2 hours, and maybe that was the issue or the hardest part. As favorite moments, this time I don't think I can say I have a favorite moment because from the middle towards the end, I mean after an hour and a bit, I felt like I couldn't pay attention to it anymore and I had a bit of trouble understanding it. But I can say that Linda Hunt, whenever I see her, she's just amazing. I think she brings such good performance in every single role that she does. And I think that all overall, this whole movie had really, really, really great actors that were able to make it better and good. And even though I don't have a favorite moment, and even though maybe it's not one of my favorite movies, I think it was good movie that had a great potential and still has. And what I'm saying each time is that I don't like when movies are being remade after 20 years and when people are trying to re-say a story that's already been said because they are trying to add things that maybe do not belong in there.
Interesting, of course, in the Timothée Chalamet incarnation, which Denis Villeneuve has actually produced, I think a lot of people were panicking that they weren't going to get the chance to make a sequel. But fortunately, box office post-pandemic was sufficient to actually merit the final things being done for that. And of course, we haven't forgotten the I think something like 8 hour miniseries, TV miniseries that Sci-Fi produced at the turn of the century. So I think Dune again as a mythical treatise, without which arguably no Game of Thrones, because certainly what Herbert does here is very much argue with the four great houses of Harkonnens and the Atreides, and of course the guild Highliners and so on. So I think that, so some interesting points that are actually made there. And go on to obviously echo the lines of both Phil and Jared in terms of how the thing develops, how it evolves, etc. What about, I mean, Linda Hunt, of course, we didn't mention earlier, probably best known currently for NCIS Los Angeles, in which she is effectively the head of operations there and does a fine job from that perspective, or was from that point of view. So what about favourite characters? Are you sticking with Linda Hunt as the Shaddat mates, the housekeeper, or are you looking for some left-field characters?
I was thinking also of Francesca Ennis. She's an amazing actress as well, even though I haven't seen her in as many things as I did with Linda Hunt. I think she really brought up her role, and she was really good in it. So I'm going to stick with these two.
Okay, the Imperial concubine, of course. Lady Jessica, who is also a member of the Bene Gesserit sisterhood, and clearly Duke Leto Atreides agonizes over whether he should have actually married her, and of course the whole notion of eugenics and genetic bloodlines and so on. Folk often sort of say, why was it that we didn't have any kind of computers in there, or we had human computers as in Mentat, Piter de Vries and so on? Well, of course, in the original text, the Orange Catholic Bible, or the War Against the Robots, there was clearly a battle against artificial intelligence, and it was determined that actually human beings needed to actually exercise their right to rule the aspects, as opposed to mechanical robotic friends, which, again, I think is an interesting aside, given our current concerns with AI in ChatGPT.
I would say that maybe one thing that wasn't right for the movie was the timing, because I think it really brings out things that are now not a concern but are a topic now, rather than in 84 when it came out. So probably I think this was something that wasn't right back then as well. I'm not saying that people were old or were not able to comprehend other things, but they are much rather a topic now than then. And regarding Lady Jessica, all that I can say is that, as in every solid movie, they show that somehow women are able to embrace and conduct a man from behind and nation. So I think that was something that was really good put in the movie. And I think it did stick to the novel quite well, even though it was only 2 hours. I do think it stick to its best powers to the novel.
Yes, using the voice, which is pretty critical for all the work we do on a day-by-day basis, whether it's for Southside Broadcasting or indeed Siren Radio. The power of the voice, the significance of the voice, the manipulation of the voice are very critical. And we see that explicitly determined here by a technique that in normal circumstances is only employed by women, but because Paul Atreides, Paul Muad'Dib, the Kwisatz Haderach, clearly growing and developing that side of his messianic powers, that clearly that obviously needs his particular skill set as well in the sequence where Paul and Lady Jessica are being taken out to the desert to effectively be abandoned there. But of course, as we know, other things happen and they become the incarnation of the rising of the Fremen and the reclaiming of the desert planet Dune. So, as you know, reasonable scores so far in terms of what we've had. I suspect you might be the curmudgeonly one in this particular area. What is your score out of 10 going to be, Anna, for the David Lynch, Dino De Laurentiis production that was Dune? Is it a flawed masterpiece, or is it a case of never again?
I don't like to do this because I never give low scores to anything, and I think I'd be
Until...
a terrible teacher out of this point of view, but I'm going to give it a 6.5.
Oh, hi. I had a feeling you might have gone for a 4, but 6.5 is slightly higher than I thought you might have gone for that.
I cannot go to that. I don't like to fail things. Maybe I'm just thinking, even though it's not something of my cup of tea more exactly, it's a good movie, and we shouldn't judge movies or books based on what our type is or what we like. We should judge them based on facts and how they are, because it's just maybe not my thing, and that's why I have this opinion on it.
Tell me of your homeworld, Usul, of course. Tell me of your homeworld, Anna. A whole range of cultural aspects from that. As we said, next week, be intriguing to find what you make of another David Lynch epic, which, of course, led to a TV series of all manner of creative cult followings, etc. Of course, that's episode one of Twin Peaks, in which we query the question, who actually killed Laura Palmer, and was she any relation to Jared? Finally, we can finally find out what our Lady Jessica makes of David Lynch's Dune. Okay, Jessica, we've heard, as I said, from Anna, we've heard from Phil Leonis, we've heard, obviously, from Jared. What are your thoughts on this 1984 movie?
So I had actually tried to watch this before. Me and my boyfriend actually tried to watch this once, and I think we got maybe 5 minutes into the movie. And we're so confused, we decided to watch something else. So I was a bit hesitant about this. I was a little nervous. But I'm actually really glad that it made me take another look at this movie, because I think also now, having seen the new Dune, I appreciate so much more about this now, and a lot of the different ways that the effects were done back when it was first made, and the acting, and the way that Paul was portrayed. I actually really enjoyed it a lot. I think Dune, sometimes it's so expansive and so unique that I think having a bit of a summary of the book as you watch the movie can help, just to reference what's going on. But once you know what's happening, it's truly a very, well, it's an epic sci-fi opera. It's such a good space opera. And I, of course, just love that there's a character named Jessica. When my friend read the books, she was had to show me that there's a character named Jessica in it. So maybe I'm a bit biased.
It's a very key character, of course, the mother of the Kwisatz Haderach, the mother of Paul Atreides, of course, Paul Muad'Dib. The line from Duke Leto Atreides, a person needs new experiences, they jar something deep inside, allowing him to grow without change. Something sleeps inside of us and seldom awakens. The sleeper must awaken. And of course, that concludes the actual movie with the sleeper has awakened. So wokeness before wokeness even became sort of part of the whole essence. What were your favorite moments?
I think one of the parts that's always so memorable to me is the shield fighting, because I remember when I first watched it, I didn't understand what was happening. I was just very confused over, I knew they were fighting and there were somehow shields, but I think rewatching it, it just gave me a bit more appreciation for the effects that were being put in the time, and how difficult it must have been to do that whole sequence. And I think that getting to see Paul in that moment, then once you see him at the end when he's in combat, it's a great parallel, and I think that actually became one of my favorite scenes. I think also just it was very brief, but that the like head in a tank from the guild, I thought that was very memorable. Maybe not a favorite scene of mine, but a very memorable part that I thought really it sticks with you because it's truly very sci-fi, a person living this existence in a tank, who can see more because of the spice. So I think those two moments really stick with me.
Yes, the guild navigators who have effectively mutated themselves from normal humanoid shapes to become creatures that can actually fold space. An interesting take on, I suppose, the traditional way in which science fiction breaks faster than light travel or warp speed, or indeed has wormholes and other sort of our hyperdrives to actually work through that. A nice take of dealing with the immenseness and the galactic epic nature of Dune. Okay, favorite characters there?
I mean, Jessica, I think, is... I mean, I have to say Jessica, but I also really liked Paul because I think he's a very interesting narrator because he's essentially a chosen one, but he feels very accessible as far as how he is mentally. I feel like sometimes the main characters in these expansive sci-fi works can feel really difficult to kind of relate to. Like in Foundation, I find some of the characters to be a little hard to relate to, but I feel like Paul, he just feels very familiar. He seems like a person now, but just put in this epic kind of setting. And I feel like even though he becomes this person who has great control over speech and death and things like that, he still just feels like a person. And I think I found Paul a kind of boring originally, but I've been changing my mind about him.
Which is the essence of Resonance Rewind. Sometimes it enables us to take a reappraisal of texts from times past. Okay, what's your score going to be for the David Lynch incarnation of Dune?
I think I would have given it maybe a 7, but the fact that they had a guitar riff while he was riding the worm makes it an 8, just because that's an epic scene. The guitar made it even better. So I think it's a solid 8.